You have a special privilege. We have a special guest this evening. His name is Colonel Fletcher, L. Fletcher Prouty, and he is the gentleman who was depicted in the film JFK as the mysterious colonel portrayed by Donald Sutherland, who sat on the bench with Jim Garrison and told Jim Garrison that he believed that there was a conspiracy at the highest echelons of our government to murder the President of the United States. Well, of course, Oliver Stone took a tremendous beating on that, and time and again, when he was interviewed on national television, he was always asked if the interview took place exactly as it was portrayed. And, of course, Oliver Stone would say, well, no, the interview didn't take place exactly that way, but, and then immediately he would be cut off. And I think one only has to see what happened to Oliver Stone, who dared to put out a movie challenging the preconceived notion, the establishment's explanation of the assassination, to see the tremendous power that is in the hands of those who have an intention and continue to intend to cover up the background behind the assassination of an American president. So, Colonel Prouty, are you there?
I certainly am. And I like your opening, Stanley.
Thank you so much, Colonel.
It's true to life.
Well, there's so much we have to talk about this evening, and let me give you our telephone numbers, but I'm going to ask you to hold your calls until later, until we've had a chance to explore some of the background behind the assassination and the events leading up to it, because it's vitally important that you have an opportunity to understand why it was important that JFK be assassinated. Now, Colonel Prouty's first book I read was The Secret Team, and I guess that was published, what, 20 years ago?
Yes.
And then the latest book, The CIA, Vietnam, and the Plot to Assassinate John Fitzgerald or John F. Kennedy. And this is available. I got my copy down at Neil Coonerty's bookstore. It's an excellent book, and I would recommend it highly to anybody who wants to get into the background of what we're going to be talking about tonight. And I suppose we really ought to start out with a little bit about you. Could you tell us what you were doing back in November of 1963 at the date when President Kennedy was assassinated? What was your position in the government at that time?
On that date, I was the Chief of Special Operations within the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Now, that title is a military euphemism for what the National Security Council directed us to do, called supply the military support for the clandestine operations of CIA. And now, I had been doing that in various capacities at the Air Force, the Office of Secretary of Defense, and in the Joint Chiefs of Staff area for 9 consecutive years, 1955 to 1964. So my assignment in November 1963 was the support of the clandestine activities of CIA. And by having it at the JCS level, that meant that we controlled and guided all services in their support. And most people would be very much surprised to find the magnitude of that job. It ran into thousands of people all the time.
Now, did you have any responsibility as far as guarding the president, when he was touring around the country?
Well, that varied depending upon requests that came to us from the people who are required to do that work, the Secret Service. But just in anticipation of your question, I looked in the Washington Post this morning and saw that from the time Bill Clinton arrives in Charlottesville today through the time he leaves for the ball Thursday, more than 6,000 law enforcement officers will have helped protect him. Now, of course, the Secret Service doesn't have that strength. So they call upon military forces, and at times, in fact, I myself traveled for such activities, at times we would deploy specially trained units to provide the help and the manpower for the protection of the president.
Now, there was something about Dallas. Had there been another attempted assassination in Dallas on De Gaulle? What was the background behind that story?
Well, there were two things in Dallas. One was that a General Walker, who had come home from his NATO command, actually had been released from service for various things he had done and things he had said, allegedly was fired at from outside his house. A shot went through the window and so on. So that was one event. But another one that was more nationally prominent was that Adlai Stevenson, the man who ran against Eisenhower for president, and who was, I believe at the time of Kennedy's period of time, was the U.N. ambassador to New York for the government, had a terrible time in Dallas. In fact, things were still thrown at him. He was spit upon, and really a very inhospitable visit to Dallas not long before Kennedy's trip. In fact, people wanted to suggest that Kennedy should not go to Dallas because of those problems.
I see. You weren't allowed to do anything to be concerned about this. You were sent out of the country specifically on some sort of a nonsensical assignment?
Yes, this was rather interesting. Of course, in my work, I traveled an awful lot. During my tour, I traveled to more than 80 countries. So I wasn't unfamiliar with being asked to go on rather strange trips. But sometime in October, I was told by a general to go over to the White House annex to get orders for a trip to the South Pole. A group of people were going to install a nuclear plant at the South Pole, and they needed a military escort officer. And I was astounded to find out that from my work and from the things I was generally responsible for, that I was going to be sent to the South Pole. And actually, I was in Christchurch, New Zealand, on the day that President Kennedy was killed.
And didn't you comment that many of the members of the cabinet, of the president's cabinet, were sent out of the country or were out of the country at the time of the assassination?
Yes, I've tried very carefully in my book to present this in detail, and I commend really to any student of this period, one of the most unusual events that I can recall in my long service, the entire Kennedy cabinet, give or take one or two people, I mean the Secretary of Agriculture, Secretary of Interior, and so on, so were in Honolulu on their way to Tokyo. And they were in an airplane between Hawaii and Tokyo when they learned that the president had been shot. Now, that's why were they sent out of the country at that time? You see, those important people, and the newspapers lead up to that rather well, and then rather abruptly excuse the trip and all, but strangely enough, on newspapers of about the 24th and 25th of November 1963, you can find that they print supposedly speeches that were delivered in Japan by these cabinet members. In other words, their public relations people had sent the speeches ahead, and the newspapers, without thinking, published that. It's a very strange period in our history.
Well, there are lots of strange things about the assassination, the magic bullet that went to both JFK and then Conley, and then appeared in pristine condition, just laying on a stretcher there at the Parkland Hospital. But we can go into a lot of those challenging things. Before we actually get into the assassination itself, maybe we can spend a few minutes talking about what led up to Vietnam. And the rather shocking statement that you made, and of course I was aware of this, but I don't think most people were, and that is that America originally backed Ho Chi Minh at the Second World War with the fall of the Japanese, the defeat of the Japanese. The Ho Chi Minh, who was certainly known as at least as a Marxist, as a socialist, had the full backing of the OSS.
Well, you see, again, it is very difficult to look back from this point in history at 1944 and 45, the war ended in 45, September 2nd, and place the people in power and the people in different positions the way they really were. But believe it or not, Ho Chi Minh, the man that we fought that war against in Indochina for more than 20 years, Ho Chi Minh came down to Hanoi with an American Army general named Gallagher and a man from the OSS named Lu Konin. And because we did not have to invade Japan as a result of the use of the atomic weapons, we had planned to invade Japan with 500,000 troops. The equipment, the guns, the artillery, the ambulances, the jeeps, the radios, everything for 500,000 men were piled up on Okinawa, just piled up like apartment buildings, the crates and boxes and pallets. And they were all of a sudden moved and put on transport vessels, this equipment for 500,000 men, and half of it was sent, and this is September 45, half of it was sent to Syngman Rhee in Korea, where we had a war in 1950, and the other half was delivered to Ho Chi Minh in Hanoi in September 45. We backed Ho Chi Minh. We created the force of his army by giving him all these modern weapons, and then eventually turned around and became his enemy when we supported the French in their drive to regain their colonial power in in Vietnam until they were defeated in 1954 at Dien Bien Phu, defeated by the weapons that we had provided to Ho Chi Minh ourselves. It's quite a story.
Well, you know, some people say that we sometimes have the best enemies money can buy, and certainly you commented in your book that most of the weapons, literally all of the weapons, that Ho Chi Minh and his forces were using against the French were American weapons that we had sent there in 1945, and then those were the same weapons that were used against our forces and against the Vietnamese forces during the Vietnamese War.
You know, you can add to that. When Ho Chi Minh defeated the French at Dien Bien Phu, by that time we had provided the French over $3 billion worth of arms, everything from aircraft to rifles, mortars, grenades, the works. And, of course, he fell heir to all of that as a result of his victory in 1954.
And then you begin to develop the idea that we brought Mr. Diem, President Diem, knew his brother into power, and they set out to destabilize South Vietnam. At that point, Ho Chi Minh controlled the north part of Vietnam, and Diem and his brother controlled the south part of Vietnam. And you mentioned a number of things that they'd done, actually, to destabilize this society. Would we go a little bit into the background? Because I think it's fascinating for the listeners to understand that this was a traditional, very conservative society, was a stable society, and suddenly, with CIA and American interference, we literally destroyed the whole fabric of that society.
One of the most unnoticed events of the Vietnam warfare period was the movement of 1,100,000 North Vietnamese to the South. Now, just imagine if 1,100,000 people from, we'll say, Seattle, were suddenly moved to Santa Cruz and just left there. You know, no homes, no money, no food. You'd have counterinsurgency just so they could eat. I mean, they'd be stealing food. What else could they do? But that was done in Vietnam under the guise of being a humanitarian effort, because the Geneva Accord when the French finally were defeated had a little paragraph that said that anyone in the North who chooses to live in the South will be permitted to do so, and anyone in the South who chooses to live in the North can do so. And they thought, you know, several hundred people might move, or various people for financial interests or whatever might move. But the CIA had created an organization called the Saigon Military Mission. It was infrequently in Saigon. It was not a military mission. And most of its activity were what you and I would call today terrorism in North Vietnam. And as a result, over 1,100,000 people were moved south. 660,000 were moved by U.S. Navy vessels, and the other 300 or so thousand were flown in airplanes, transport aircraft, that were under the control of the Central Intelligence Agency. And interestingly, there's only one major port in South Vietnam, and it's at Saigon. It's up a river. So they brought these people up the river, dumped them out of the ships, ostensibly said they would take care of them in little towns and so on, but they scattered all through the most luxurious part of Vietnam, the southern part, the rice fields, the paddies, the wealthy villages there, and of course, being homeless and penniless, they demanded food, they demanded help, and they became an enemy that very soon we called Viet Cong. We called their activity insurgency, and we began to fight insurgency. But the strange thing was, it's as though Canada wanted to attack the United States, but started fighting in Florida. How could that be done? Well, the main part, the most agitation in the war, at least in the time that Kennedy was president, was in the very southern part of Vietnam, the furthest away from North Vietnam. And that was due to this forced movement of that enormous number of people. And you know, Vietnamese don't travel. They live in villages, and they have what they call ancestor worship. They don't drive around in their cars. They stay there for centuries in the same village, and then you uproot a million of them, and you think you're going to create a stable. It was really one of the most make-war efforts ever done in any country by anyone.
And then, of course, there were a number of sects there. There was the Cao Dai, and there was the Buddhists, and there were a number of people who had they were stabilizing forces to the community. They'd been there for, I suppose, hundreds of years. And they were, one after another, undermined. There was a man named Lee Van Vien or something. He was sort of a pirate south of Vietnam, south of Saigon, and he was gotten rid of, and the emperor was gotten rid of, and the Cao Dai was gotten rid of. And what were all those various organizations? Why did we undermine the fabric of this society, this peaceful society?
I think the big word, give or take, that by giving them all those arms, we intended to have a war there. I think that we would admit, if we looked at all the facts, that our activities were to create a war for reasons that are still not entirely clear. I think we could clarify them if we thought about them very long. But that's the first thing. And to make a war, there's nothing better than to transplant stable people, take them away from their homes, their villages, their farms, their activities, whatever they're doing. A lot of people in Vietnam were in the lumber business. Many of them worked for the enormous French Michelin tire company and were very well employed. Vietnam was, according to the National Geographic, was the nearest thing the National Geographic could say with the Garden of Eden on Earth. It was a beautiful place. In fact, I was a transport squadron commander over there in the latter part of 1953 and 54. Now, in 54, remember, that was when the Battle of Dien Bien Phu took place. There's plenty of fighting going on in Vietnam. But from Tokyo, I was ordered by the generals who were fighting our Korean War, or winding it up at that time, to fly wounded and hospitalized men to Vietnam for rest and rehabilitation on those wonderful beaches in the southern part of Vietnam. In other words, the men winding up the Korean War thought Vietnam was a resort, was a Waikiki or a beach country, Monterey and Carmel, let's say. And so I had about 12 aircraft in my squadron. I would get orders to fly hundreds of men to Vietnam, not for warfare, but to go to the beaches and recover from injuries and so on. That's the way we were split. The military thought Vietnam was a Garden of Eden. The CIA was producing a war ground.
And, of course, one of the things you brought out I thought was so interesting was that the CIA convinced President Diem to force all of the Chinese out of the country. And, of course, they were the merchants. They were the people who made the society work economically.
Yes, you know, if you live in that kind of an economy, and actually Vietnam was quite wealthy as things go, they exported 600,000 tons of rice a year just before the war began to peak. In other words, their balance of trade was plus for them. And obviously, if you're a rice farmer, fixed to your land, no trucks, no highways, you depend upon some sort of a brokerage system to bring your rice to market. Now, the old system was that you would go down the canal in your own boats delivering your rice to the village, mark your rice, and then the Chinese would come at every harvest time, and the Chinese would barter, trade for textiles, for silver, for salt, and other necessities, and would buy the rice and put the rice on the world market. And for hundreds and hundreds of years, that system of the Chinese entrepreneur and the Vietnamese farmer had made all of those people in the southern part of Vietnam relatively prosperous farmers. And it was a peaceful deal that if we hadn't come along and ruined it, it would still be that way.
And this was, of course, the CIA in those years between 54 and 63 when the president was assassinated. And so from what you said, we forced the French out, and they were a stabilizing influence. We forced out the Chinese. We destroyed the sects. We brought in the 1,100,000 people into South Vietnam, and all of this was being engineered by the CIA?
Well, you see, this is another thing that people don't seem to recall or put in context. As I said, when we first went down there with Ho Chi Minh, one of the principal leaders there was from the OSS, the forerunner of CIA. The CIA stayed in Vietnam all through that period. By about 1959, 1960, the CIA felt that they needed helicopters. So they called upon the military, in fact, they called upon my office, to provide the first squadron of helicopters. Now, they are military helicopters flown by military pilots and with military maintenance people. The Department of Defense did not approve that request for the CIA because we felt that it went against the agreements of the Geneva Accord in 1954. But through measures that Allen Dulles was able to use, especially with his brother being the Secretary of State, we were called by the White House, National Security Council, and ordered to provide the helicopters. Now, in order to do that, we had to bring in military people who were competent to fly them and maintain them and supply them and all that. So that introduced military people into Vietnam, but not for combat purposes, and most importantly, not under their military officers. It was 1965, 20 years after we had made our first moves into Vietnam, that military troops, U.S. Marines, landed on the beach at Da Nang and served under their own military officers. That's the first time the military was involved. Now, you see, that's after Kennedy's time by 2 years. And yet people think that Kennedy is, caused the escalation in Vietnam. It's absolutely wrong.
In fact, actually, Kennedy, shortly before he was murdered, had actually written a directive that we were going to start pulling out of Vietnam, hadn't he?
This is the most contentious point of Oliver Stone's movie and our attempt to tell history as it is. Because on October 11th, 1963, after months of careful study and the management of his top leaders, Secretary Rusk of the State Department, Secretary McNamara of the Defense Department, and his National Security Council, and many, many assistants from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, among them my own boss, General Krulak, they were planning a policy that Kennedy was dictating to them, that we were going to bring all U.S. personnel out of Vietnam by the end of 1965. Now, those words that I've just said are quoted from a document that was issued by the White House, the highest level document the White House could issue at that time, called a National Security Action Memorandum. It's number 263. And despite the fact that the document can be obtained in any library, it's in many books, but poorly quoted, and in the Pentagon Papers, the so-called history of the war, it's terribly presented. They fractured it. They put half one place and half another place. But never mind those problems. The document exists. It was Kennedy policy. My boss worked on it. I worked on it myself. I know about it. And furthermore, there is now a marvelous government printing office book called The Foreign Relations of the United States for the period August to December 1963, Vietnam, Volume 4. And that book relates a whole series of meetings leading up to that document, what it meant, and what Kennedy's intentions were. There can be no doubt, despite the fact that every newspaper and magazine says that Stone and I were wrong on this, there can be no doubt that that's the history of the event, the way it really happened.
Now, for a guess, anybody who may have just tuned in, let me remind you that you're listening to Radio Liberty here on KFER 89.9 FM on your radio dial. Our guest this evening is Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, who actually served as the consultant to Oliver Stone for the movie JFK and was depicted in the part played by Donald Sutherland. Well, we're going to get to the assassination itself here in just a few minutes, but there were a number of other items that you felt were important. In other words, Kennedy wanted to pull out of Vietnam, and there were people who wanted a war there. In fact, they'd been working at that point almost 10 years to destabilize Vietnam. They had financed very well the enemy. Ho Chi Minh, having gotten half of the equipment we'd sent from Okinawa, and then all of the American military equipment left over that we had given to the French after Dien Bien Phu. So there was a situation. This was an ideal situation for a war if you wanted one. And here's this upstart young president coming along and saying he wants to pull all of our troops out, get everybody out by 65. What other things did our president do to irritate or antagonize the establishment?
You know, in the context of that question, I just can't help but think of the immediate situation, because our new president is inheriting one or two real major trouble spots on an ongoing arrangement that has not been really solidified as far as policy goes. When Kennedy became president, the Bay of Pigs program was in motion already. The men had been trained. They were in foreign countries being trained. They had an air force. The Bay of Pigs Cuban exiles had an air force larger than any air force in Latin America. They were equipped with enough weaponry so that had they established their foothold on the beach, they could equip 25,000 people to help them in their goal to overthrow Castro. It was no casual event. Historians have not done well by the facts of this case. But Kennedy inherited that. The decision to train the Cuban exiles had been made originally in the Eisenhower administration time in March of 1960. The invasion of the brigade in Cuba, as you will recall, came in April of 1961, or in other words, a year later. So Kennedy inherited the program in motion. In fact, when Alan Dulles briefed him about this program, Alan Dulles said something to the effect, and this is in print and can be looked up by anyone who's interested, that, "Mr. President, it would not be wise now to change the policy that we already have begun, because all these Cubans are in training and all these Cubans expect to go back and defeat Castro, et cetera, et cetera." In other words, gave him no alternative. And then finally, when Kennedy approved the movement of the brigade for the invasion on a Sunday, April 16th, before the day they were to land on the beaches, there was one more step. We had had a bombing run over Cuba on Saturday, on April 15th, because Castro had 10 combat-capable aircraft. He had no big air force. He had 10. In that Saturday morning raid, our B-26s, the Cuban exile B-26s, destroyed 7 of his aircraft. Unexpectedly, 3 of his aircraft, and they were jets called T-33s built by the Lockheed Company and well-armed, had flown to another city, Santiago, and they were not touched by that raid. So when the military chiefs and the CIA people briefed Kennedy on Sunday, and oddly enough, Alan Dulles, the director of Central Intelligence, was out of the United States on that crucial date. This is something that few people have ever been able to explain, why the man in charge wasn't there. So Eisenhower went off to play golf instead of being leader of the invasion of Normandy.
Unless maybe it was intended to lose.
Well, see, A lot of those questions come up when people begin to know the facts of the case. Obviously, that kind of a question rises. What was his intention? Why did he do that sort of thing? But anyway, on Sunday afternoon, when the military briefed the president and told him such things, and I'll read this. This is factual. "The Cuban Air Force and naval vessels capable of opposing our landing must be knocked out or neutralized before our amphibious shipping makes its final run on the beach. The realization that the main reliance for the destruction of Castro Air Force must be placed on the D-Day strike," that's the strike the morning of the landing, "Kennedy approved, he ordered the D-Day strikes. And yet, in this report that I have, we find that in paragraph 43, under the highlights of the operation, a committee study put together by at direction of Kennedy, they write this: at about 9:30 p.m. on 16 April, Mr. McGeorge Bundy, special assistant to the president, telephoned General C.P. Cabell of CIA to inform him that the Dawn airstrike the following morning should not be launched until they could be conducted from a strip within the beachhead. Mr. Bundy indicated that any further consultation with regard to this matter should be with Secretary of State." Now, General Cabell was the deputy to Dulles. He was a good intelligence officer, but he was not a combat commander. From the time he got the call and he ordered the cancellation of the strike that Kennedy had, because of this call, he ordered the cancellation of the strike, even though he knew the president had directed it. And then, as the story goes, he went around Washington trying to locate Secretary Rusk. Well, in the meantime, as the clock ran, the time for them to take off in these B-24s that were going to bomb the jets